Welcome to the Excel Pod.
Welcome to the Thinking Kingdom podcast. We have a great episode prepared for you. We have Dan Owen with us. Dan, say hi or something, anything.
Hi, here's what's left of me. I'm glad to be with these two guys.
We give him such a hard time. We're going to play Versal first, as you know, as is tradition. And we'll do that. We'll kick it over to Dan. And if there's anything in Nate's brain or my brain, maybe Dan needs some help sometimes. With some Bible. You think that's the case ever, people?
I absolutely do.
Probably not. Probably not ever. Let's bring up Versal if I got it somewhere here. Versal, Dan, I'll read you the reference. I'll pull it up on the screen for everybody. Here it is.
Are you going to read me the reference?
I'm going to read it to you right here.
Okay.
Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Now let's see those gears turn in your head.
Well, I think you're being kind to me today, McCrickard.
Hey, this is what it was given.
Well, you're in Exodus 3.
Okay, there we go.
And you're down there around, I don't know, somewhere between 6 and 8.
All right, you want to split the difference and do 7?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, it comes earlier, so you guess 7. It is in the ones place, so it comes earlier. So you want to try your 6 again?
Let's try 5.
Let's do 5. There it is. You see it on the screen, people. Dan Owen, round of applause. A scholar and a gentleman.
3 verses or so.
What's that? Yeah.
I missed it by 2 or 3 verses.
Oh, you're okay. You did good.
What is your thought process? Like, are you thinking of a picture on the page, or are you thinking?
I'm thinking of kind of the page.
And
I'm thinking, I know it's Exodus 3, and I know first the angel of the Lord speaks to him out of that bush, and he sees it, and then the progression is to the. And I know what happens down around verse 14, when he says, I am that I am, and you get down there. So I just kind of split the difference, and there you go.
Well, we just like to see what's going on inside your head.
Sometimes I'm not sure what's going on inside there.
It can get to be pretty scary.
Is that a peeled orange back there on that book?
This is a Honeycrisp apple.
Oh. The color.
And I like to teach a couple of hours and then have me one of these. It gives me more energy so I can keep on teaching. Honeycrisp, I recommend it to all of your listeners.
You're in Hebrews right now.
I am in Hebrews.
We're talking about Bear Valley
classes. Yeah, Bear Valley classes. Yeah, you are
I'm teaching Hebrews. I'm actually in Hebrews 10 right now with my class.
Well, that's kind of where the context kind of picks up for our class today a little bit. With the enduring.
Yeah, now don't steal my thunder, McCrickard.
Sorry, I'm very sorry. Let's kick it over to Dan. We're going through Hebrews chapter 12 and the Hebrew writer's use of the Proverbs passage and the Exodus passage here. I'm going to pull Versal up on the screen. Dan, Logos on the screen. And Dan, where are we at? What's the Hebrew writer trying to do and chapter 12 to advance his message through these scriptures, these Hebrew scriptures?
Well, the actual backdrop for our passage in that he uses the Proverbs in is Hebrews 10:26.
Okay.
Excuse me, Hebrews 10:36.
Okay.
Where he says, you have need of endurance that having done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. And he uses the word hupomone, endurance. And then, of course, to demonstrate this endurance, which is a synonym for being faithful, he quotes Habakkuk 2:3 and 4, which says, and yet a little while, he that is coming will come and he will not delay, and my righteous one will live by faith. But if he shrinks back, I will have no pleasure in him. Well, I would translate that my righteous one will live by faithfulness, which is the same thing as endurance over the long haul. And then he tells you in chapter 11 about all these faithful people who endured until the end, and they hung on and they were faithful to God in this and that scenario, either even under great persecution. And then in the first couple of verses of chapter 12, he goes back to this idea of enduring to the end. And he says, you know, since we're surrounded with the great cloud of witnesses, which is all those people that were faithful to the end in chapter 11, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily besets us, and let us run with endurance. There's our word, hupomone, again. The race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, this is an example of endurance, for the joy set before him endured the cross, that's hupomone again, despising shame, and sat down on the right hand of God. But then in chapter 12, verse 3, he again uses the word endurance there, or patience, depending on how yours translates it. It says, consider him who endured such oppression. See, endured, endurance, you know, all the way through here, going back to 10:36, which set up the faithfulness passage for us. So he's talking about enduring the sufferings of life and still being faithful. That's the context of what he's talking about when he gets into the thing in chapter 12, verse 5, where he quotes Proverbs 3. And so what I was going to tell you, Yehus, is that his use of these Old Testament passages here is different than what you've been talking about with those other dudes about those other passages.
Okay. In what way?
Well, it's different because those other passages were proof texts for proving Christ in Christianity. He was trying to show how the implications of Psalm 2 and Psalm 8 and Psalm 95 and Psalm 110 and Jeremiah 31:31-34, how the implications of those passages prove Christianity, prove Christ, prove that the law had to be done away, prove all these things. So those passages were proof texts about Christ, which is at the core of what he's doing. The Proverbs passage and the Exodus and Deuteronomy passage that come up later in this this chapter, they're not used in that way. He's not trying to prove anything except about Christ. He's simply trying to apply this idea of faithfulness and saying that God's children have to endure suffering like regular children have to endure discipline. And they have to be faithful through suffering like regular children are faithful through discipline. And so he just uses a wisdom passage out of Proverbs where the father is talking to the son in Proverbs 3. And the father is telling the son not to look down on or despise or disrespect the value of discipline, because discipline is given, it's correction given by a father who loves us and who wants us to become better. Now, this is where a lot of people have their misconceptions, because a lot of people think that this must mean that the people the Hebrew writer is writing to or us have done something wrong, and so we need to be punished. That's really not the idea. One of the key verses here is verse 11 of chapter 12. He says, no discipline. I would rather translate the word discipline as training in this passage. But training is unpleasant. Training hurts. See, McCrickard, you probably never went through any training, but Nate, I'm sure, like in athletics and stuff like that. I'm just messing with you, McCrickard.
Hey, Austin's sneaky athletic.
Is he really?
He is.
He is athletic?
It's within me.
Okay. All right. He's sneaky. I didn't know that about you, McCrickard.
It's okay. I forgive you.
All right. So training is difficult. It hurts. And he says in verse 11, no discipline or training seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. So what he's trying to say is that if we allow our sufferings to train us, sort of like the disciplines of a loving father train us to be better people, then we come out with the fruit of righteousness. But if instead of allowing our sufferings to train us, we resent our sufferings and we resent God and we become angry with God and we turn away from God when we're suffering and struggling, then we're not trained by it. It causes us to lose our faith. So what he's saying is think of whatever suffering you're going through as good training in your faith, training you to have a better perspective, training you to be a stronger Christian. And if you think of it that way, you will be trained by it. That's how he seems to be using the Proverbs passage. But it has nothing to do with proving Christ or proving Christianity. He's telling them, you know, like in verse, what is it, 3 or 4, he says, you have not yet resisted unto the point of shedding blood. See, they've gone through a lot of suffering, but they're still alive. And so hold on to God during that suffering and become stronger as a Christian during that suffering and be trained by it. That's his message.
So it seems like in the, you know, through really the Habakkuk passage, like you said, the proof texting, he's laying the foundation for their faith in Jesus, and he's given the reason why they need to continue to struggle. And this is how you do struggle. This is how you live faithfully. Kind of, I don't want to say the application, though I guess it could be.
It is the application. It's not the proof. It's the application.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My question is, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. In context, is their suffering and the thing that they're enduring, is it the struggle of hanging on to Jesus as opposed to the Jewish system?
Yes.
And the temptations and the pressure that would cause? Is that the suffering?
Yeah, go back to chapter 10, verse 32 and following. Read us 32 through 34 there, Nathan.
But recall the former days when after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plunderings of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Gotcha.
Yeah. So then right after that, see, he says, do not throw away your confidence. And then in verse 36, you have need of endurance. And that takes us right into the faithfulness passage and right into our passage that we're going in right now.
Okay. I was hoping that you would expand on something that I guess is a little fuzzy for me. I can make it make sense, or I'd probably rather you do that, but the peaceful fruit of righteousness, when we go through these sufferings, this discipline, this training process, it produces what my translation says, later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. In what way does our training yield this peaceable fruit, and how does righteousness play into it? I guess how do both of those words play into the training process?
Well, I think what he's talking about is when we go through suffering with God, trusting in God, believing in God, knowing that God loves us, you know, knowing that God cares for us, and we hang on to God through our sufferings, we come out of the other side of those sufferings at peace with God and at peace with ourselves. We're not hating God. We're not resenting God. We're feeling that we've been through this, and now maybe we can sympathize with other people who have been through the same thing, and our faith has become stronger. Even though it's against my own rules, I think of Romans 5, verse 2, we rejoice in hope of the glory of God, and not only so, but we boast in our afflictions, knowing that afflictions produce steadfastness, and steadfastness produces approvedness, and approvedness produces hope, mm-hmm. and our hope will not be disappointed. So you kind of have a similar idea there about the benefits of suffering to a Christian who hangs on to God instead of turning away from God during those sufferings. And that seems to be what finally yields this peaceful fruit of righteousness. And that simply looks like, I'm going to try to do right and follow Jesus no matter what happens to me in my life. It's not based on whether I have to suffer or don't have to suffer.
Okay. Would you connect this term righteousness back with the Habakkuk passage at all, with the righteous shall live by faith? Or,
well, yes, and I would, and that's a good question. I think it's a very refreshingly leading question, because you already know it connects back there. But the righteous shall live by faithfulness. If you go through chapter 11, the word righteous or righteousness appears in chapter 11 too. You know, and their righteousness was shown through their faithfulness.
Okay.
And so, yeah, the righteous one shall live by being faithful,
which is tested through the sufferings and training. And okay. That's some good connections.
Maybe. So see, these guys are looking at the big picture of Hebrews, and they're trying to connect the dots and the threads through the book of Hebrews. And these are not disconnected passages, as y'all well know. They are all following the same line. You've got, in Hebrews, you've got hold fast as a synonym for faithfulness. You've got be diligent or diligence. You've got endurance a number of times as a synonym for faithfulness. And all of these kind of get you into the same idea that it's not a 100-yard dash, it's a marathon, it's painful run, but faithfulness means going to the end no matter what.
Okay, Nate, anything there, or is it before we transition to the Exodus passage?
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about a moment of application. Like for us, I always have a hard time when I'm preaching on passages. Me and Austin just talked about this too. I always have a hard time preaching the application of suffering mm-hmm. and endurance. You know, endurance is, I guess, a little bit easier. We have to endure, but problems aren't in our face like they were in the first century. And so for them, it was returning back to the Jewish system. You know, I guess what are some tangible real life applications that we struggle through that is not getting taken out into the square of the city and getting beat for our faith?
So I think that Hebrews 12 and these other passages would apply to people who go through any kind of suffering. Losing your job, getting cancer, going through a divorce that you wanted no part of, being ostracized by the people that you depended on. You know, there are many different things that could, you know, losing all your money in some situation, having somebody cheat you. You know, there can be all kinds of different things we can suffer. And we, like those people, maybe under different circumstances, would ask, why, God, would you allow this to happen to me? And that would be the I'm blaming God, I'm turning against God, I'm not trusting God to carry me through this. And so other than that, we get closer to God. We double down on our prayer life. We seek to do his will and trust that he will take care of us. And we come out of the other side with peace and a righteous life, and we can empathize with other people. That's the difference. That would be the way I would apply it.
Yeah. What point that really I liked in the classes that you've taught Nate and I in is that Esau example, that he traded something very valuable for just a nearsighted moment. And that's what we do. Right. And that's what we're tempted to do sometimes is, okay, I'm going through this struggle. God must not love me, so I'm going to give up. Or
And you're trading your valuable soul and your valuable relationship with God for just your emotional disquiet in that moment.
Yeah. I think that's huge. I just really enjoyed that wisdom there of using that Esau passage where he had something greater, but he was just hungry. Well, we have something great, but we're going to disregard, you know, our great reward, going back to chapter 10.
Yeah. But McCrickard, you're using it just like the book of Hebrews uses it. And that's what's great.
And that's because we were taught well. Moving into chapter 12, verse 18, this kingdom that cannot be shaken. This section has been a little more difficult because I do feel, I understand the, you have come to, but now you come to Mount Zion. And so what's the comparison there? It kind of makes, is he saying that the Old Testament system isn't the one that's supposed to be withstanding? Is it something? He kind of casts some darkness over the Old Testament that, help us through that.
Well, this is really not something that's different in the book of Hebrews, because think if you go all the way back to chapter 1, God spoke to the fathers back there through the prophets. But in these last days, he's spoken by his son. Chapter 2, if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, then how shall we escape if we neglect this great salvation? So you've got that one contrasted with this one. You have in chapter 8, the first covenant contrasted with the second covenant. And of course, you're going back to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand and lead them out of the land of Egypt, which takes you back to Mount Sinai, which we're in here in this passage. So he's, you know, even in chapter 9, and you guys probably forgot about this part, he compares the first part of the tabernacle and the second part of the tabernacle to the first covenant and the second covenant and the pre-Messianic age and the Messianic age. And so really all the way through, you know, in the Psalm, what is it, Psalm 40 passage or Psalm 45, where he says, sacrifices and offerings you did not want, but a body you prepared for me, whole burnt offerings for sin, gave you no pleasure. Then I said, here I am to do your will, O God. And then in Hebrews 10, verse 9, he says he takes away the first that he may establish the second. Well, there's the first sacrifices and the second sacrifice, first and second. So you really have that same phenomenon happening here with the two mountains, you know. And he's taking them back to the Exodus scene, Exodus 19 and 20, which is the trembling and quaking of Mount Sinai. And he's contrasting that with the place from which God is speaking through Jesus, because see in 12:25, see that you do not refuse the one who is speaking now. See, well, that's actually taking us all the way back to chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. But the Mount Sinai is God spoke in the past there, you know, and now in Mount Zion, he's speaking to us from heaven through his son. And so that's really what he's doing in the grand scheme of things and putting those two things together. And that was a very tactile, sensory, scary experience. And now
you're saying
Mount Sinai, and now he's speaking to us from heaven, which doesn't seem as scary, But he says, you know, that he uses, what is it, Haggai that he uses here, Haggai 2, verse 6, where he says, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. There he's making a comparison between the shaking of the ground at Mount Sinai when the whole mountain trembled and the future shaking of the heavens and the earth when God removes the things that will be shaken and leaves the things which cannot be shaken. So he's going back to, you know, you're a member of a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And you don't want to give that up. You want to be faithful to that.
You think there's any connection with this, you know, this Mount Zion, in that Jesus' blood as the mediator of a new covenant speaks a better word than Abel, in connection with Mount Zion? Or is he not contrasting that with the Old Testament? Because he brings up the blood of Abel too.
Yeah, he definitely sprinkles a lot. Sprinkles a lot of things in here. But Mount Zion was, of course, the place of the temple, the place of sacrifices and all that. But he mentions the heavenly Jerusalem there, the city of the living God. He mentioned that back in chapter 11, verse 10, and chapter 11, verse 16, where he talked about Abraham was looking for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And 11:16, God has prepared for them a city. And here in this passage, the heavenly Jerusalem. And then in 13:14, we do not have here an abiding city, but we seek after that city which is to come. So he's comparing Mount Sinai and that covenant and Jerusalem and its temple and all that stuff to the heavenly Mount Zion and the heavenly Jerusalem and the true temple of God. You know, even back in chapter 9, he talked about the fact that the true temple is in heaven and the earthly temple was just a copy of the things that are in heaven. And so he's reaching back into there and pulling all this stuff that's greater and better about the situation that you and I have as Christians.
So let me ask you this. How is this not a proof text that kind of builds on what he was trying to do earlier? Because I do see this kind of dichotomy between the old versus the new. Or is it just still?
Well, it's definitely a comparison, but it's not a proof text in the sense that he's saying. Now, I'm talking about the Exodus passage here. The Habakkuk is actually, the Haggai passage, Haggai 2:6, where he says, once more I will make not only earth, but the heavens shake. Mm-hmm. That passage is viewed as a prophetic passage that prophesies of the future destruction of the earth. And goes along with the idea of Jesus' second coming and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But the Exodus passage is not a proof text of Christ. It's simply a comparison.
Okay. All right.
See, for example, if you go back to Jeremiah passage, the days are coming that I will make a new covenant. Well, God said he was going to make a new covenant. Therefore, and he said it was not according to the covenant I made with your fathers. So God already said that the covenant Sinai is going away. That's a proof text of Christianity.
Gotcha.
The priest, you know, how can God promise to make the same guy king and priest and after a different order if he's going to stay with the Levitical order? Because he'd have to change the law. See, that's a proof text.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
When I say proof text, I mean he's trying to prove by the implications of these passages that Christianity is real and legitimate and you can't get away from it.
Okay.
It also feels like his tone here in this section of the book is different than the proof texting section of the book, you know, before.
It is.
And he's saying he's gone through the endurance stuff. You know, Jesus is from the Old Testament. He's done that in chapter 1 through 10. We're going to talk about, so you need to endure. And now he's coming back in 12:18 and saying, okay, so remember, and he's maybe making that comparison again in a different tone.
Remember, you're not here. You're up here.
Yeah.
and don't refuse the one who's now speaking to you. See, that's his, he's really in his application section where he's saying, don't let your sufferings turn you away from God, like the wise person of Proverbs said, and be careful to realize what a wonderful thing you have, and don't turn away from the one who's speaking to you now.
Like the way in our conclusions, we might reach back into our opening illustration to tie it all together.
Yeah, this is definitely a tie it all together passage that we're in Hebrews 12. I know you guys are good students and you're interested in this, but the hermeneutics of Hebrews. You could say that you must say that there are a number of passages he uses to prove the legitimacy of Christianity. And then there are just some passages with principles in them that he uses to apply what we've learned in it, and comparison passages for comparison's sake. But those are different. Those are used differently than your proof texts are used. This is a hermeneutical discussion. You need to look that word up, McCrickard.
It's a big one for me.
I know.
That's a lot of syllables.
Would you say that this is a rabbit trail. The command example, a book like Hebrews and the complexity of the hermeneutic in Hebrews, would you say that the command example necessary inference, there's some nuances that we should delve into? I mean, not in this, but would you say there's more to it than the sinny hermeneutic?
There is. If you tried to boil the hermeneutics of Hebrews down to command example and necessary inference, you would be completely ignoring the hermeneutical ways of the writer of Hebrews.
The voice of the book.
He would say, what? Now, he would not deny that God's commands are valid. He would tell you that in different times, God's made different commands. But that is a template that's been put over the scriptures. It's not the way biblical writers necessarily approach texts. Which is what you were trying to get me to say out loud, Nate.
I was. I don't know. We all know this, but the more we study, the more things are not nailed down, the more the paper starts to flip up on one side, and we try and nail every corner down, and it just does.
It's just that when you let scripture do the talking and you see how the writer uses those passages, it's really enlightening, because let's face it, in the first century, how did they preach Christ? They preached Christ from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And they used these passages from the Old Testament to help legitimize, through Christ, Christianity.
Hey, while we're...
we were going to let that just stand as it was, but go ahead.
To bring it back to the material, what is the blood of Abel? I mean, I'm lost. What is the blood of Abel, and what does it have to do with anything?
Well, in Genesis 4, is it verse 10, somewhere around that neighborhood, the voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Mm-hmm. Well, Abel's blood was crying out for vengeance, for justice, for God to punish Cain, you know, and the blood of Christ, as he's shown, is for forgiveness and mercy and grace, you know, to take away sins. And so the blood that's sprinkled on our hearts, like back in 10:22, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water, Hebrews 10:22.
That's right.
That's sprinkled with the blood of Christ. And if you go back into chapter 9, you've got, what is it, 14, 15, somewhere in there, you've got the blood of sprinkling that sprinkles on people in the Old Testament to make them from unclean to clean. And then later on, the sacrificial blood that was sprinkled on the people to seal the covenant there. And then you've got The blood of Christ was actually sprinkled on the heavenly tabernacle to purify that tabernacle. And so all of that connects. We've got blood sprinkled on us that speaks better things. It's not crying out for vengeance. It's crying out for mercy. And I like that as a preaching. I think that would make a great sermon, just talking about the blood of Jesus and the blood of Abel.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
But you guys need to develop your own sermons. I'm not, no, you can't just, I'm
taking mental notes.
No. We always joke it with our little friend group from Bear Valley about how we would turn in a sermon and you would say, pretty good, 75.
Basically and, a good sermon, 68.
Yeah, basically good, 80.
Yeah, well, the word good was in there, so I was happy with it.
Yeah.
See and all.
You guys are funny. I like y'all.
Well, thanks for taking us through this. It's provided a shot in the arm for us as far as kind of capping off this Hebrew study. So we're done. We've had Corey on. You've had to suffer through my teaching. And who else did we have on here?
Did you have Denny on for part of it?
Oh yeah, we had Denny. Yeah. And he took
what part did he do?
He did Psalm 95 with the
If you shall hear his voice, harden not your hearts.
Yeah, he did that, and Psalm 110. He had a thick section to run through because it spanned from chapter 3 through 7, pretty much.
Yeah.
So, but he hit all the high points, and yeah. Yep.
Dennis Del Petrillo. Okay.
Other than that, that's it. Thank you, Dan, so much. We always enjoy, and thank you for your time. I know it is.
You're welcome.
It's at a premium, but.
You're a good man. I appreciate and love both of y'all.
All right. Like us on Facebook. Go over to YouTube. Do all the things that I normally tell you to do. Subscribe. Turn on notifications. Also, go over to Dan's YouTube page. Dan Owen. Search it. And if I can remember, I'll provide a link to his YouTube page. Let's kick up the subscribers. He's got a lot of good views going on. He needs this audience because he's got good stuff. He's well-studied. And thank you, Dan, so much for taking us through this. We appreciate you, brother. And that's all I have. Nate, anything? All right.
Chris Bapple.
Nate's out.
See you all. Thanks. God bless.
Bye.